the redemption that happened in the darkness. Only with hindsight and with insight, we can see what was miraculous about it. But Chanukah doesn't have anything written about it. It's in the period after the night has already set in, after the darkness has already begun. And let's look at some of these elements and see what we can draw out of them. What we hope to achieve with this discussion is we hope to be able to answer the question, what is Torah Shabbat then? What is the oral law and why do we learn it and why is it so hard? Now that's a question that bothers a lot of us, especially people who come in to an environment like this looking for some kind of spiritual connection, and they sit you down with a piece of text which is legalistic and detailed and very difficult and highly intellectual, and at first glance seems to have no deeper spiritual feel to it. Why do we need that? What's that doing for us? If Torah is a purely spiritual experience, why do I need legalistic wrangling? Why do I need this thing that's Torah Shabbat people with all its strange presentation of things? The Mishnah says something and someone else, the Gemara, says that the Mishnah is actually missing pieces, and it gives you the missing pieces. Why didn't they put it into the Mishnah? How am I supposed to know that? Sometimes you look for a thing in the Mishnah and you don't find it. Some distant source has the answer, and it says that Divrei Torah are like that. They refer in one place and mention another. Why did they put all the things together where they should have been? Why is it so difficult? Why is it such a brain-grinding search? What's it got to do with Chanukah? That's what we want to try and answer a little bit if we can. Now, the issue of revelation and the miracles that happened until Purim. What we have to understand is the following thing. A nes, a miracle, really means a revelation. That's what it means. A nes, literally translated from the Hebrew, means a banner. You know what a banner is? It's like a flag. It's something you can see. It's a revelation. Revelation means something that you can see. That's what a nes is. We're not impressed by the fact that nature turns upside down. That's not the important thing about a miracle in itself. Nature is also miraculous. An example the other day, that when Moshe Rabbeinu split the sea, he had to do something, he had to put out his rod. When he got back the other side, he had to put out his hand. He also had to do an action. That's a very strange thing. Usually nature should take over where the miracle's not needed anymore. Do we see not? Nature's also a miracle. Also needed something to be done. Now, that's a beautiful chat about Moshe Rabbeinu. Really, a miracle should stop when it's not needed anymore. As soon as the Jews were through, Amishel was through the sea should have come back again. No, it's no more miraculous that it's level and horizontal than it should be split, really. And we're just used to it the one way. So the fact that nature's this way or that way is not what impresses us. The fact is the sudden change, sudden revelation of something you didn't see before, that's what's spectacular about a miracle. And that's why the word nes, which means a miracle, is the same word meaning a banner. Banner's where you're ready, where you can see. It gives you a clear sense of identity and a clear revelation. Now, Jewish history was one long miracle until Purim. Right from the beginning, the way the deeper sources put it is that the world was awash with what's called Lashon Kodesh. That means the holy language, the language of spirituality in the world, was all you could hear. For example, the creation itself was an expression of this thing called Lashon Kodesh. That means when Hashem created the world originally, He spoke. And His speech was the world, which means that yet, if you were around to see it and you had the spiritual sense organ, you would have, the same organ that would have heard Hashem speaking would have been the organ which experienced the creation, because Hashem's word is the creation. That's why the Hebrew word for davar, which means a thing, is the same word as the word for a word, because a word and an object are exactly the same thing. Just an object is a word of Hashem, that's all. So it's not accident that the creation was made by Hashem speaking a thing. The thing is, today we don't understand this concept of speech, because today the way we speak is so cheapened and such a weak tool that the only way we can express anything is by talking around it more and more and more and more until we finally get the picture. Or we do it more conveniently by having conventions. When I say table, you know what I mean. Just because we have a convention that grunt which comes out table to you means the same thing as what I mean. But it's just a convention. But Hebrew is not like that. The real Lashon Kodesh, even Hebrew today, is not the real Lashon Kodesh. It's just the external vessel that once held the light, which is called Lashon Kodesh, happens to be Hebrew. But the world was created with a very powerful language, which was so powerful that it was the creation itself. That's how powerful it was. Right after that, there was a phase where the whole existence of the world was predicated on that level. That means anybody who saw anything in the world saw the reality. There was no way to mistake it. And if you think about it, until that time, until very, very late in the world's history, until after Purim sometime, until right after that, there was really very little, if any, distortions of the truth. That means if you find people who rebelled against it, it's because they knew what it was and decided to rebel. They're not people who mistook and were lost in the darkness. That's our problem now. That's our problem. We're in the darkness and we're lost. But people in that generation, when the temple stood, for example, a Jew's ordeal wasn't whether he believed or not. He saw miracles all the time. He experienced the revelation. He didn't have an ordeal about whether to believe. He had other ordeals, bigger ones than we had, much bigger. He had a different Yetzirah. He had a tendency to negativity that we've kind of experienced today in certain specific areas. But to know that there was a transcendent reality was no problem. He experienced it directly until this watershed event where the lights went out. Let's trace back a little bit and see. That Lashon Kodesh in the world, that spiritual and divine language, which was the world itself, continued until the story of when humankind got together to try and build something which would reach into the spiritual dimension, whatever that means. Build some kind of city and a tower. You remember the story in Chumash? And they wanted to reach up into the source of where the spiritual forces flow down, and they want to cut it off from its source, whatever that means in its deeper levels. At that time, Hashem's response was that he broke down language. It was the first break in human language. It says, Haba Nerda v'navla sham svasa. Let us go down and let us mix up their language. What was happening? Human beings were using language, this very powerful language, wasn't they speaking to each other? It means they were using this expression of connection between the spiritual and physical world. That's what Dibur is. Dibur meaning speech, is the connection between Mahshava, the thought level, and Maisa, the action level in the world. It's that perfect connection where one reflects the other perfectly. They used that in order to make the perfect connection between physical and spiritual. The Mephoshim say that the city and the tower that they built was Jerusalem and the Beis HaMikdash. That's what it was. What was the city and the tower? What does it mean, Irum Mikdash? They wanted to build a city and a tower. What's that mean? Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. What is that? That's the connecting point. Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash is the connecting point between the spiritual world, the transcendent dimension of power, and its expression in the world. That's exactly what it is. They wanted to do the same thing. They wanted to build that connection, which is exactly what they started building. And they had very powerful tools at their disposal. The tools were Lashon Kodesh, which is the pure expression of reality in the world. There was no stopping them. With that tool at their disposal, there was no way to stop them. So it says Hashem came down and confused their language. Navla is from the root Babel. Babel means the Babel, which is the confusion of language, which was a breaking down of the tools that they were using to achieve this spiritual level. So the way Hashem thwarted their effort was to come down and mess up language. Now they couldn't speak to each other. But it doesn't mean, like a six-year-old understands, that they all spoke Hebrew. Then Hashem came down and he did something, and now when one man said something, another man came out Zulu. But he couldn't understand Zulu and he couldn't understand Swedish, and so the building stopped. That's not what happened. It means much deeper than that. It means that communication became distorted, such that when I say something, you don't understand what I mean. And that's the curse. That's how we live today. Today, it's impossible to say anything that anybody else understands. Today, people live together for a lifetime and never began to understand what the other one was saying. That's our problem. But in those days, it wasn't so. Hashem came down and he did that, and that stopped the work. There was no way after that damage was done to connect perfectly anymore the spiritual and physical dimensions. That's what that break in language achieved. It was a tremendous dampening of revelation in the world, tremendous reduction of the power of the connection, and that's what happened. But the same dimension of power was left, still left on earth in the one thin thread that's called Lashon Kodesh. Prophecy. Nevuah. Prophecy. Abraham understood it, and there were other great men on earth who understood it. Not everybody anymore. It wasn't an open tool like it had been before. But there still was that thread of Lashon Kodesh in the world. And that was a tool of revelation. And a prophet was in contact with it. And the whole world looked different when prophecy existed, as we said many times. It's not that prophecy doesn't mean that in that generation, under P in the phone book, you could find somebody who could tell you, you know, what the weather was going to be tomorrow. That's not what it means. The whole world looked different when there was prophecy around. Everybody's consciousness was completely different at that time. And so the world continued for centuries, with prophecy handed down to many people. There were more than 1 million prophets in the Jewish nation over a period of a few hundred years. And that was a direct experience of revelation. While the revelation existed in the world, once again, there was no ordeal not to believe. Ordeals were in a different area. For example, there was a tremendous drive, tremendous negative drive in the world. While that voice spoke in the world, there was a tremendous negative drive to idolatry. That means to connect up with a source other than the correct one, to fabricate a connection to a source of negative power or a non-source, as opposed to the source of power. That's a drive that we don't experience today. It was rooted out of the human nefesh, the human neshama, and we can understand what it means. But it was one of the strongest, if not the strongest drive that a human being had. That drive was in the world to balance out the force of revelation. Prophecy in the world was a revelation so great that there was no free choice to disobey it. If a person like us would have experienced whatever prophecy was, the force of when you heard a prophet speak, it wasn't that he told you something that sort of sounded true. When a prophet spoke, it was an experience of endless. There was no way to deny it. There was no way to deny it. You actually experienced it. You actually experienced the thing. He didn't tell you something which you then interpreted. You actually lived and saw and experienced the thing that he was saying. That's what Lashon Kodesh means in the world. Anybody who lived in that kind of revelation didn't have any drive to go out and worship a piece of wood. They're pointless and crazy. So what happened was, in order to balance out free will in the world, that same part of the human nefesh that maintains connection, the same part that connects with Nebuah, that can receive Nebuah, that same part of the human neshama, which is has transcendent power, that same part was infused with a tremendous negative drive. And that negative drive was the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. It was a tremendous negativity which drove a human heart to seek a connection with an impure source. Finally, what happened was, when things dropped to a point where even that level could not be maintained, prophecy was ceased. Prophecy ended. And it's no accident that it happened in the same place that the first shattering of language occurred. The first time that language was damaged, was broken, was in Babel. It says it happened in a country called Babel. That's where it was. The second time it happened, the prophecy was killed, fragmented, and finally finished, and never reappeared again, was in exactly the same place. No accident. A place called Babel again. In that place, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah decided that it was time that the risks of the balance of power as they were not worth taking. What did they do? They said like this. They said to Hashem, we now have a power of prophecy. We have a power of connecting with tremendous power, source of the world. But the risks involved are too great. What are the risks? That same connection with power can lead us to connect with our own source. And they saw that the world was falling to a point where the risks outweighed the benefits. So they said, what we're going to do now is we're going to shech that Yetzer Hara in the world. We're going to root out that drive to negativity in the world, which is a man's drive to the impure source. And they did. Moreover said that they called it up. They called it up it came flaming out of the Kodesh Kodashim, this negative human drive that leads a man to Avodah Zarah. It came flaming out of the Kodesh Kodashim. No accident that it came out of there. Should be apparent. That's why it came out of the holiest place on earth. And they killed it. They destroyed it. No more drive to Avodah Zarah in the world. But at the same instant that died, prophecy died. The price they paid for killing the drive to negativity was the connection with the positivity. And it had to be that way. There's no way to kill a Yetzer Hara in the world. They couldn't take an abstract thing, Yetzer Hara, and kill it. But they could dampen and crush and cover a certain part of the human nefesh. A certain part of the human neshama, human soul, they were great enough surgeons to do that. And they did it. They dampened and switched off a part of the human neshama. Which part? The highest part. The part that connects to transcendence. And that had two immediate consequences. One, no more drive to negativity, just a vacuum in its place. We don't feel any drive to go take a piece of wood and call it the source of existence, and it sounds absolutely impossible to us. That is what happened. But at the same time, the ability to connect with the MS, we don't have to keep it. That Lashon Kodesh called Nevuah, which was the absolute connection to the MS in the world, the same part of the human neshama must have both, because of the spiritual rule, that anything that has power for the one has power for the other. That's what they had to do. And they said to Hashem, we don't want its reward, and we don't want its risk, and we don't want its reward. We have to sacrifice the reward in order not to damage ourselves by the risk. And when they did that, the world went dark. In that generation, when they severed that connection, many things happened. One thing is this thing itself that we're discussing now. Another thing that happened is that the beginning of certain impure lines of thinking in the world's history began. Because on the day that Ezra died, a certain force was born, a certain person was born in the world, I don't want to go into details, and founded a system which to this day is a system that is very, very close to the pure connection, but it has distortions, serious distortions, which will go to the end of time and be rooted out finally. Tzadok and Baitis, two people before that generation, who started in the days of the early Tanoim, after Shimon and Tzadok, started systems of thinking which were not in line with the truth. That had never happened before. It couldn't happen before. With Lashon Kodesh in the world, it could never happen. But two or three generations after that light died in the world, it became possible to introduce into the world philosophies, and the Greeks happened to be at that time. Now Sheikh Nessus Hagdela, one of the last of whom was Mordechai, from the nation of Purim, they were the people who changed, who caused this change in the world. And it was like the world began again. And the Greeks, in that and the next generation, the next few generations, was the Greek world. And at that time was Shimon HaTzadik, who went out to meet Alexander. And the world was swept by a philosophy which had never happened before. A philosophy of complete disconnection between the truth and between what we see. What was Greek philosophy? Well, what we see is what we deal with. What I can experience directly is what I believe in. You want to tell me stories about some abstract roots and transcendent powers, and I'm not interested. What I can philosophize about logically, and what I can see and measure scientifically, that's what I'll deal with. You tell me there's something higher, and I can feel stirrings of some sort of striving to lift myself higher, I can have intimations of nobility and of transcendence. Those are something else. Those are evolutionary. I know what those are. Those are not real. I'll deal with what I can see. And there was nobody to controvert that. There was no one to say that wasn't true. Because the proof that anybody had before disappeared. The proof that anyone had ever had before was a direct revelation in the world. Even if it was only Purim, which was a revelation which was in a hidden fashion, being the last, right? Purim was the last nace which led us into the darkness, which was a hidden, but at least it was a nace. It was just like Esther. Esther is the end of the night, like the dawn is the end of the night. It was a revelation. After that, there was nothing at all. And there's many aspects of evidence that we have that the world began new at that time as a new creation. For example, we have a system that the Jewish documents are dated by the date from creation. There's a system of dating documents which begins from the first year of the rule of Alexander. First year of the rule of the Greek, we have a system, there's a thing called Minyan Shtaros, which we call that year zero, year one. A whole world was created again at that point. Created in darkness, no revelation, a whole new world. And many other changes as well. We've discussed before the fact that until that time there were no brachos, almost no blessings. People didn't make blessings in the world. And today, can you imagine a Jew without a blessing? Imagine a Jew without a siddur today. It's impossible. Everything's a blessing, from when you wake up to when you go to sleep, the beginning of life to the end of life. Everything's blessed. One blessing, one bracha after another. Before that generation, there were no blessings, except for one or two derisive blessings. But rabbinic blessings had not been enacted. When somebody ate an apple, he didn't say a blessing. He said something he had, but he didn't say the formalized form of blessing. That what happened? And who are the ones who introduced the blessings? Like Sheikh Nessus Hagdela. The same people who switched off the lights, who severed prophecy, who stopped that flow of force, connection to the source of the world, they introduced blessings. You know why? Because a bracha, a blessing, is a connection to the source. Baruch atah Hashem does not mean that I'm blessed. It doesn't mean we're blessing Hashem. A six-year-old will understand that that's not what we mean. When we say Baruch Atah Hashem, what it means is we are acknowledging the source of bracha. We are saying that you, Hashem, are the source of blessing. Which means that we're putting the source back into our lives. Why? Because when you take an apple, it looks like an apple. An apple is not an apple. An apple is a word of Hashem. That's what it is. A davar means an object, which means a word. And this apple is a word of Hashem, and I'm the listener. He's speaking to me. When I eat an apple, I'm listening to a word of Hashem, and there needs to be a listener. His speech is going to make any sense, there has to be somebody listening. And that's a dialogue between Hashem and myself. That's what it means when I eat food in the world. But before that time, you didn't need a blessing, because the source was apparent. An apple spoke to you. An apple spoke to you when you pick an apple from the tree in those days. It spoke to you. It said, I'm a word of Hashem. It says in the mystics, it says in the sources, that in the next world, when the redemption comes, when the revelation appears once again, it says that when a man picks a fig from a tree, today if you pick a fig on Shabbos, nothing happens. It says in that generation, when you pick a fig on Shabbos, the fig will shout, Shabbos! Because it has to. Because as soon as the revelation shines in the world, so the brim will speak again. So before, when the lights were still shining in the world, when you could see clearly, when you took something from the world, it spoke to you, and you didn't need to make a blessing. You didn't need to reconnect to the source. So there were no blessings. But when the lights went out and they stopped all that, a person can take an apple and think it's an apple. That's a tragedy. That's missing the whole point. That's missing the point of being alive. So they made brachas on everything, because we don't see the source of anything anymore. So they made blessings on everything after that. And today there's nothing we do that doesn't have a blessing, because everything, we're in danger of seeing it disconnected, which is Greek philosophy. Greek philosophy is everything's disconnected from the source. I deal with what I can see. Don't hack me about what came before and where it comes from. I deal with what I can see. So today we have to, that was another major change. So the same people, and Sheikh Nessus Andreva, the same people who switched off the currents, the connection, the same people had to make the tikkun that would make it possible for us to live through the darkness. What did they do? They gave us brachas. They gave us Shmona Esrei, Havdolas, Kedushas, brachas, Tfilas. All these things came from them. The Shmona Esrei that we done. In case anybody should think that there was any revelation afterwards, you should know that the second temple, which was at the time of Moshe Bessus Adela, compared to the first temple, was no revelation at all. Although it was a base of Mikdash, but it was darkness, pitch darkness compared to the first. It said that people had seen the first base of Mikdash. When they saw the second, they cried. Because the missing, the miracles, the revelation that had been there in the first place of Mikdash, didn't exist anymore in the second. And you want a bigger proof? Look in the Shmona Esrei. You'll see in Shmona Esrei, davening that the Anshei Knesset Sardela constructed, right? Return us to Tzion. Bring us back to Yerushalayim. Build the base of Mikdash again, right? Bring us back. What do you mean build the base of Mikdash? It was composed while the base of Mikdash stood. The Anshei Knesset Sardela were writing these tefillahs at the time of the second bais. And while the second bais was being built, Ezra and Nehemiah were building the second temple. While that revelation was being, so-called, so relative revelation was being constructed in the world, what prayers were being composed? Hashem, we see nothing anymore. Bring back the bais HaMikdash. Bring back Tzion. More than half, or almost half, close to half, the brachas in Shmona Esrei are for the redemption, for the gula, for the revelation again. And that was the time when the bais was. Because the second bais was nothing. It says that in Shemaim, there's a bais HaMikdash connected to the first bais. That means the first bais has got a parallel transcendent image, which is going to appear in the final revelation, which is the third bais HaMikdash. The second one doesn't have a parallel. It was nothing compared to the first. The first was the real revelation. The rest was in darkness. It was a revelation in the darkness, but it was nothing compared to what was there before. It was in the time when it was in the time of brokers, and we need to make brokers. Now, that watershed event was at the time of Hanukkah. Greek philosophy took over the world, a disconnection between the source and what we see. After the time of Nebuah, no more prophecy. There's a very sharp notion in Chazal that says that the second fragmentation of language, the first happened in Babel, and it says that the man who kept it alive at that time was Abraham. Then the second fragmentation was again in Babel, where prophecy died completely and there was nothing left. The Chazal say it's like a man says to his wife, the man divorces his wife and he says, go back to your father's house. That's what Hashem said to us. Back to Babel, the place you came from. That's where we came from. That's where Avraham Avinu was from Babel. Ur Kasdim was Babel. Ur Kasdim, the place where Avraham Avinu grew and was nurtured and grew up and became who he was, is the same place, Babel. Out of that destroyed language came the reconstruction of language. Avraham Avinu, who heard the language, he heard the connection. He fought through it, he had to reconstruct it. He was an old man before the voice spoke to him clearly. He had to reconstruct it in his relative darkness to get it back. That's what he did. And later in history, when we deserve less than that, Hashem sent us back to the same place, it says, like a man sends his wife back to her father's house, divorces her. And in that place, the final fragmentation of language occurred, Lashon Kodesh. No more Lashon Kodesh in the world, and that's when things went dark. Now, at that time, the last flicker was Purim. The last nace, the last flicker of a light was the miracle of Purim. And even that you had to ask to see. It wasn't obvious. The name Esther means hiddenness. Esther means to be hidden completely. So the last nace that says is like the dawn in the night was a miracle that itself was hidden, preparing for the long, long, almost endless night that we're in now. And right after that came one last event, Hanukkah. An event that happened in complete darkness. No miracle at all that could be seen, at least not could be written. The Gemara over there says, what do you mean that Purim, Esther, is the end of Nisim? The Gemara says, you have Hanukkah. After Purim, you have another nice Hanukkah. The Gemara says it wasn't given to be written. Lo Nisan Levi Kosei. Up to there, the nisim were such that they were to be written down, become part of Torah, become part of written Torah, and Esther and the Megillah being the transition, and then Hanukkah was the last miracle that occurred, like a miracle of darkness completely not allowed to be written down. It's part of the secret behind why you find that in the Torah Sheba Al Peh, which is the Yom Tov of Hanukkah, Hanukkah is the Yom Tov of the Torah Sheba Al Peh, the Oral Law, you find that in the Oral Law Hanukkah is completely hidden. There's no Masechta dealing with it, like there is for Purim. It's not mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah, which is the Neshama, you know, the letters Mishnah spell Neshama. The Neshama of the Torah Sheba Al Peh, which is the Mishnah, Hanukkah is not mentioned. Although we have a principle that every halacha of the Torah is mentioned in the Mishnah, you won't find Hanukkah Refresh. You'll find Hanukkah mentioned in Gemara Shabbos. No accident, because Shabbos is the redemption. Shabbos is the final Geula. No accident that it's there. And it's in the chapter on lighting the Shabbos light. That's where you'll find Tamei Madrikin. That's where you'll find Hanukkah. Hidden away at the end. Buried, uncovered, secretly hidden. That's where it is. Not like Purim, not like the Nisim that happened before. Hanukkah's buried and hidden away at Shabbos. Why? Because without any Megillah, there's no Megillah of Hanukkah. There's no written Torah about Hanukkah. Because that's what Hanukkah is. It's the miracle that one last candle that has to light our way to the final goddess. This long, interminable goddess that we don't know the end. We have no prediction. We can't figure out when it's going to end. We have one last candle that was lit in the darkness. It wasn't even allowed to be written down. And that little candle burns throughout the night of this goddess. And we don't know when it's going to end. But it's got to last us. Whatever amount of oil was put there has got to last us to the end. That's why... The Sassiamis says, brings an amazing thing, that the Nair of Hanukkah, that one light that we light, you know, the minimum mitzvah for Hanukkah, today is the first day of Hanukkah, mitzvah is one candle. The mitzvah of Hanukkah is Nair Yishuv Beisim, one candle for a person that is home, that's all you need. That one little light is parallel to the Nair Maravi, the western light in the menorah that burned in the Beis HaMikdash. That's what it was, that's what was lit permanently. That light burned miraculously all the time. When the Kohen Gadol would come in each day, the oil had always lasted and that light was burning. So the light never went out. The Sfasimis brings that just like the Mishkan has been hidden away in the world, the Beis HaMikdash has been hidden. All the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash have been hidden away. They're buried someplace. We don't know where they are. We know that they exist. We know that the Kalim, the Menorah, the Shulchan, everything exists and it's hidden someplace. Somewhere buried deep there's a Menorah. And you know what? It's still burning. That Ne'am HaRavi is still lit. It doesn't go out. We just don't see it. We don't know where it is. But when we discover the menorah, it will be burning. That's what it is. That's the whole point. It's just in the darkness. We don't see it. But it had enough shemen to last, not just till the Kohen Gadol came in each night. That oil will last until the Mashiach comes, until the final Kohen Gadol comes and lights the whole menorah again. That's what it is. It's burning. Wherever it's buried, it's still burning. The Sfasiamis says that when the light was hidden in the world, and when that menorah was buried, it was buried in each human being. That just like the universe has a human structure, so the human being, the kelim of his Beis HaMikdash were buried also. That means that for that long night of goddess, where those kelim are buried, they're still burning somewhere but we can't see them, in each Jewish neshama, the kelim have been hidden. We don't recognize the Beis HaMikdash. We don't look much different from animals. We live in a system where language, the Lashon Kodesh in the world, is so perverted today you can't hear a word of MS. It's a mace today. The only mace goddess today that anybody can hear any MS in the world, with what's been done to Lashon in the world, and Dibu. That light, those kelim have been hidden inside. And we have to bring it out. And the connection and the way to light that light and bring it out in any human neshama is Torah Sheba Al Peh. Because that's exactly what it was. The Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law, was the response to the hiding of the light. How does that work? First of all, the fact. The fact, as we said, you see that in many ways, Hanukkah, the Torah Sheba Al Peh, Hanukkah is very, very much connected with it. The Torah Sheba Al Peh is a unique thing. It's a written document, but only written as an emergency measure. It was forbidden to be written down, to maintain it as an oral thing, to maintain it in the hearts and minds of Talmidei Chachamim and Jews who learn it. It was not allowed to be written down. But as an emergency measure, the Mishnah was written down before it got lost. And later, the Gemara, as another emergency measure, was written down as well. But it was written in an oral fashion. Take Mishnah without a teacher, without a kabusa, without the throb of a live human contact, then it's meaningless. Take Gemara without the live experience, and it's meaningless. Even Gemara explaining Mishnah is meaningless. You cannot figure it out. You find the things in Mishnahs, as we said before, Mishnahs that shouldn't be there. seemingly. There are things that should be there and aren't. You find them in some distant place. There are things that you search for and don't find. When you learn Gemara, which explicates and brings out these things, there are things that seem to be missing also. Tremendous effort to bring back what's hidden. And no place do you see it greater than Chanukah. As we said before, it's not mentioned at all. You have to search and find it. It's buried. And that's the message exactly of Parashat Vayikra. Why is this the response to the darkness? Why this construction of a Torah Shebaal Peh that seems so difficult? And there's so many hidden crevices and so much effort and has to be maintained alive as a human experience. Why is that the response to what happened at Chanukah and happened before, to the darkness? The idea is like this. And this is the most important thing, because if we understand this, then we have a concept of why we do it. Why we sit down and break our heads to learn a piece of Gemara, this is the reason. There are many other reasons, but this is fundamental. And that is like this. And when Lashon Kodesh died in the world, there was no more voice of prophecy in the world. There was no place to recapture that sound in the world, except by a means called Torah Shebaal Peh. That means the world was crashed into fragments of language. There was no place anymore to hear a Dvar Hashem. The prophecy that had lit up the scene was gone. So when a person wanted to hear now in the darkness a piece of Nevuah, a piece of Hashem's Lashon in the world, there's only one way. To reconstruct it ourselves. To rebuild it ourselves. And that's the secret why the Anshei Knesset HaGoyla, it's no accident if you read in Pirkei Avos, the Mishnayos, written by Anshei Knesset HaGoyla, talk about that generation of the people who switched off the lights in the world. What does it say about them? The first thing it says about them, Haim Amru Shlosha Devarim. They said three things. That's a fascinating thing. Never in the history of Torah, before then, did you ever hear a statement that somebody said something. Isn't that amazing? Where's the Haim Amru of Yoshua? Where's all the Divrei Torah that Yoshua said in the Beis Medrash? Yoshua said beautiful things, you can be sure. He said a lot of beautiful Torah. All the Nevi'im, the Shoftim, all the people who said the most beautiful Divrei Torah, where are they? Where's the Shas that recorded them? Where's Yoshua's Divrei Torah? They're not recorded. You know why? Because he never said Divrei Torah. He never said his Divrei Torah, he just said Torah. The flow, the current in the world was so alive that what he was saying was part of the flow. He was linking in and expressing what Torah was saying in the world. You saw it all around you and you heard it from him too. But it wasn't recorded as his thing that he said. Only when the lights were switched off and things went dark, then you have Haim Amru Shloshet Dvarim, that those human beings, they said. Up to then there was never, it was much greater than a human being speaking. When Yeshua spoke before, when one of the Nevi'im spoke, just like Nevuah was coming from his throat into the world, his Divrei Torah were coming through him as an agent, relatively speaking. But after the darkness set in, there was nobody to say it anymore. None of it. You couldn't find it anywhere in the world. So a human being had to take it in himself to say Torah. So Anshei Knesset HaGoyla found the Torah in the world. Haim Amru Shloshet Dvarim means that from now on in, the world is founded on these three things because we say it. Al Torah, Al Avodah, Al Gemilos Chasadim. The Mefloshim ask an amazing question. What are they telling us? They're telling us now in that generation that the world is founded on these three things. We didn't know it before. Ask any 6-year-old who never heard of Anshei Knesset HaGoyla. He goes to Chayde, he'll tell you the three things the world's founded on, the three pillars on which the world stands: Torah, Avodah, Avodah Hashem, and doing kindness, Chesed, which is the foundation of the world. We needed Anshei Knesset HaGoyla to come and tell us that. They're not telling us that. What they're telling us is that before, the world stood on the Dvar Hashem. That's what it stood on. The pillars of the world were Hashem's word in the world. Now the world stands on these three things by human creation. And by the way, one of the greatest mystics of the last generation, the last century, expresses the same idea in an even more potent way. He takes exactly this point and he shows that the very idea of miracles in the world, the very concept of a nesh, a miracle in the world, was radically changed from that generation on. Before then, miracles in the world were the direct action of Hashem in the world. And you could see it. And when Hashem did something in the world that went against his own creation of nature, such as splitting the sea or reviving the dead or any of the great miracles that happen in Tanakh, it's a very, very big thing. It's an amazing thing. It's so big that it's written about in Tanakh. But after the darkness, after this phase, after the phase of the Talmud begins, miracles happen all the time. The Tanaim revived the dead, split rivers, split water, put their foot over a snake and showed that the bite of the snake doesn't kill. Maruk and his wife ran into a fire and didn't get burnt. Ran into a fire, into an oven, stood there without getting burnt. Right? Many, many times. One of the junior Talmidim in the Beis Medrash of Revi revived the dead. Just at the drop of a hat. And Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor who saw it, wasn't impressed at all. He said to Rebbe that I know that the smallest in your base midrash can do a miracle like that. So what happened? What happened? What happened in the world that miracles were such a big deal that they hardly ever happened, and when they happened they were direct action of Hashem? And after this phase, when the lights went out, miracles are commonplace. Today, of course, we're much below that. It takes a tana. Took a tana to do a miracle like that, to revive the dead. But nevertheless, until the world fell below that level too, today we're nowhere. But in that phase of darkness, when you had people great enough, they did miracles all the time. He explains like this, that the world was given over to human hands. When it says, what Hashem was saying was, I'm stepping back. I'm stepping back. The revelation is leaving. With the light, with the dying of the light, you're losing me. I'm stepping back from the world. When anything is running the world down, it's by your action, not by my direct action and interference in the world like it was before. Now it's up to you. If you have enough Torah, you can do miracles. Enough Minus Fasadim, you can do miracles. Enough Abayda, you can do miracles. And that's what happened. If you go through all the miracles in Shas, you'll see that each of them is founded on one of these three things. Talmid of Rebbe, you revived the dead. Torah. Maruch and his wife ran into a fire, they weren't burnt. Chesed. They were fleeing from a poor man who they'd given stock and they didn't want him to know who they were. So they hid in a fire and they weren't burnt. In other words, if you became a master of one of these three pillars of the world, you became a master of the world. But it wasn't possible before. When the revelation was great, it wasn't possible to do that. But only now that the world is given over to a much, much, much lower level, where the truth is not apparent in the world anymore, then human authority took over. Explains many things, this principle. I'm going to take too much time from the side, but just to mention one detail that's very useful to know also, is that when a prophet was tested before, when a prophet came and said prophecy in the world, what happened? He had to say something that would happen, and it had to happen exactly as he said. That was a test of Nebuah. But that stopped when prophecy ended. Why? We can't test a man like that today, because people can do things today. And only in an age when a man couldn't do anything by himself, where only Hashem directly could do. So then if a man said something and it happened, it was a proof that Hashem had sent him, because it was Hashem doing it directly in the world. But in this night that we're in now, if a man came along and did not chesed, he could generate a miracle. Of course Hashem is always present and he's doing everything that's in the world. But a totally different understanding of what it was before. And that is the final fragmentation of language. That darkness that we're in now is the final fragmentation. And the response to it was, Hey Mamu Shloshet Dvarim. They came in the time of the Greeks, and they said, we're taking it on ourselves now. We've got to reconstruct it. That human opinion, and look at Mishnah, look at Talmud, it's all human opinion. If Yehuda says this, Rabbi Meir says that. And out of the argument between them, what is argument? What is argument? It's darkness. It's shattering of the image. Two opposite opinions in Torah. How is that possible? How is it possible? But out of that argumentation, fragments of non-emes, as it were, a havamin. Why is Gemara written to have a havamin and then a maskana? Why is this a strange construction, that Gemara first gives you a havamin which is wrong? What do I want to know what's wrong for? List emes for me. Why do you first give me what's wrong and argue about it, and argue and argue and argue, and then come out to what's right? Because it's a reconstruction of the emes from broken fragments. That's what it is. It's a reconstruction of the light by human opinion. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda are reconstructing the light of Torah in the world. From their own neshamas. They're lighting that spark of that last candle that's burning in their neshama. And putting those fragments together to come out with emes. And that's why Shas looks like it does. Human opinion of this Tana and this Amira and that one, argumentation, wrong ideas, another wrong one, before finally we get the emes out of it. And and it's due to this process of human thinking, of human reconstruction, which is what Talmud is. And that's what keeps us going. That's what's keeping us alive. The last flickering candle that we have through this Golos is the Talmud, is the Shas, is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. The non-Jews have also got the written Bible. That's not what keeps us alive. What keeps us alive is that which can never be written. That's exactly what Hanukkah is. And it's no accident that we study Talmud Babli. Where does the Talmud come from? From Babel. The same place where language, where Loshon Kodesh was fragmented and fractured. That same place is where what we learn is Babel. The Yerushalmi is not the same. Yerushalmi is a much clearer light in many ways. The Bavli is a Talmud that comes from a place where language was fragmented, and it's the fragments from that very place that are being put together. That's why it's not in Hebrew, it's in Aramaic, it's in a language of the that tends towards a negativity relative to Hebrew. In reconstructing it from that language, that's what it is. And that's a deep secret in why when we see the deeper Jewish sources, the deeper, the more transcendent sources, put it this way, they say that the phase that existed before was a phase of vision. You could see clearly. When there was light, you could see. Person could see. Re'iyah. Re'iyah means seeing. Which is, by the way, why the Hebrew word ra'iyah is a proof. The same word, which means seeing, is the word that means a proof. Because when you see it, what can you say? Chronology. There it is. It's not coming. So that phase of the world's history was a phase when humans saw. Now you can't see. It's dark. All you can do is hear. And hearing is a sense in the neshama, the koyach of hearing, translated into the koyach of the nefesh, is a sense that takes place only in the darkness. Why? Because vision, you see outside of you. It doesn't happen inside. The scene is outside of you. You see it all at once. That's what vision means. That's what re'iyah means. Hearing isn't that way. Hearing happens only in the human mind, in the human brain. One syllable, and then the next, and the next, and the next, and you do the reconstruction. That's what hearing is. Hearing is something that we do in the darkness. It's not meaningful. If all the sounds that a person, if two people were having a conversation and one person wanted to express his idea to the other and he tried to put all the sounds together and say them all at once, you wouldn't hear anything. You'd hear a noise. The only way you can hear is one piece and then the next and then the next, and you reconstruct it. One fragment, then the next fragment, then the next. Each fragment meaningless. Each syllable, each sound meaningless by itself. But the reconstruction, which is what you do, then we do it inside. That's what hearing is. Very different thing from seeing. And that's why the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud Babli, which is the reconstruction in the darkness, always says Tashma, come and hear. Come and hear means, I'm not going to show you, I want you to hear it and put it together for yourself. And that's why Talmud is such a difficult experience. Because it's not being fed to you, no one's showing you pictures, you're not seeing a proof. On the contrary, you have to find it in yourself. Until you open the channels, until we open those channels in ourselves, until we put the fragments together in ourselves, the light doesn't come on. That's why no matter how clearly somebody explains the Gemara to you, it's meaningless until you suddenly get it yourself. The good teacher will only show you, he just bumps you to the edge and then push you in. But it's only when you fall in and suddenly get the idea that you can learn Gemara. Nobody can explain it to you, no matter how clear. And you had that experience many times, that somebody explains it to you over and over and over and over until you can say the pieces off by heart. You still don't know what it means. Right? You wake up the next morning, you suddenly understand what it means. Well, there's a connection of the fragments coming together, which is a higher function of the das, which is spoken about many times, which is an internal experience. That's what happens. That's what Gemara is designed to do. It's not designed to be easy. It's designed to be a knot. It's designed to have speed bumps. That's what Gemara is, to make it difficult, so that you pick your way through the fragments, not knowing what's going on. The more you discover about it, the worse it seems. As soon as you get a flicker of light, it crashes and it seems worse than before. Right? And worse and worse and worse until somewhere, someplace, a light starts to come on, but you can only do it yourself. Because only inside where that light is burning, hidden deep away, is where the fragments can be reconstructed. And until we can do that in the darkness, we're not going to see anything. That's why Talmud Bavli always says Tashma. If the Yerushalmi and the Zohar, they never say Tashma. They say Tachazi, come and see. Is that amazing? It's only the Bavli, it's only the Talmud that we are experiencing reconstruction, that you have the expression Tashma. Come in here, I want you to put it together, says the Gemara. I'm not going to tell you anything, I'm just going to present you fragments. I'm going to make it worse. I'm going to give you an argumentation. I'm going to take it to three pages, and it'll only be a Havamina. And I'm going to destroy it and wipe it out. And then when you think it's a Maskon, it's another Havamina. Then Rabbi Yehuda's going to argue, then Rabbi Meir's going to argue, then it's going to get worse. That's what Talmud is, no? And finally, out of all those fragments, you piece them all together and realize where the emphasis is in all of them. That's what it is. That's the task of Yaakov. That's what we have to do. The Hayab, the Zohar, doesn't talk that way. And that for me is part of the message of Hanukkah. It's the last light that was lit in the darkness. It's hidden away in Shas. In that book, in that amazing book, which is the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is all the broken fragments being put together by human effort, which means me and you. That Yehuda and Rebbe Meir just started it off for us. But that's not what's going to keep us alive. But if Yehuda and Rebbe Meir wrote down on the pages of the Shas, it's not going to keep us alive till Mashiach comes. Till I open that cave and find that menorah and see that menorah maravi burning. What Rebbe Yehuda and Rebbe Meir said is not going to keep us going. It's how I relate to it. It's what happens in me, what happens in my heart and my mind when I learn Gemara. And it keeps me going and it awakens the spark in me. That's what's going to keep us going till Mashiach comes. They didn't write it down for their benefit. They wrote it down for you and me. When Rebbe wrote it down, he was thinking of you. He wasn't thinking of himself. He had it. Rebbe made a prodigious effort to write it down for you and me and for people who are going to know less than us. And that's to keep them alive. And that's what Gemara is. It's not supposed to be easy. It's recapturing and rekindling that little flame. And that's what it is. When a person looks at the menorah and he sees last night one light, one small little light burning in the window that you could miss, that's what it is. It's the light of the Torah Shabbat there. It's burning in the program of Shas where it's not even mentioned. You wouldn't even think you'd find it there. Learn a parak about something else, you'll find another Hanukkah. Just like you're walking out in the darkness, you don't expect to see any light. You look up in the window, you see one little flame, one little candle. That's it. You're walking through Shas, you don't know what's going on, it's all dark. Find another Hanukkah. Hidden away in the pages, that's what it is. That is to keep us going.